Thank you. It's great to be with you. In my previous incarnation, before I became a philosopher, I worked as a film critic for a little bit. And I used to think that the only interesting discussions that really people had must be in those great big books, dusty books that nobody reads. Started to study some philosophy, and actually I was thinking about film and I was thinking about philosophy, and I realized that some of the most interesting discussions that are happening now of ideas and heroes and all these sorts of big questions of life and faith actually are happening in movies as well as in big old dusty books. And so I'm hoping to open with you this evening this question of the hero. What is the hero in culture? And I hope it's going to be an accessible way for you to think about your movie watching, maybe even your journey, your spiritual journey. I don't know where you are with Jesus Christ this evening, or God, or the rest of it, but my hope is that I'll say a few things and maybe ask you a few questions. Philosophers tend to throw questions at you. I hope that I'll throw a few questions in your direction. They'll be helpful. They'll be constructive in your journey as you consider these questions. So first of all, I'd like to start off by just phrasing the question, and that is, why do we love superheroes? What is it about superhero films that mean that we keep going back to see the latest installment, even when, let's be honest, some of the later installments of the big superhero franchises aren't as strong as the first film that came out? Why is it that we secretly have this yearning for superhero films, or for the perfect superhero film, if you like? I don't know if you follow any of the recent franchises, the Spider-Man, the Batman, the Iron Man, all the different types of franchise, or even the comic versions. But I find superhero films a lot of fun, but also they contain some very interesting themes and questions. I have a sort of pet theory that every single one of us, deep down, secretly wants to have a superpower or be a superhero. Or maybe it's just true for me, but your laughter maybe indicates that there's some truth to that. Now, not everybody likes superhero films. One director, Francis Ford Coppola, quite a serious director, when somebody asked him about Christopher Nolan's new Batman film, said, "Well, I did see it, but it's still a guy dressed up in a silly costume to me." Now, is it just about money? Is it that these films just generate massive income, and that's why people keep making superhero films? Well, not entirely, because the films that make money are the films that tell stories that have themes in that connect with us. And then we go and buy the cinema ticket. So actually, it's hard to make money if you make a film that doesn't connect with people. So yes, films are big financial enterprises, but there's some sort of truth to them as well. What is it about a story that lifts us out of the mundane, humdrum everyday and takes us to this incredible landscape through the screen, either at home on a DVD or maybe on the laptop through a sort of streaming service or even in the cinema? What is it about those stories that we find so enticing, so intriguing? How does that formula work? How does that happen? Well, one of the things might be this idea of justice. I don't know if you followed the recent Batman films. I'm going to show you a clip from one of them now, which I think speaks to this. Batman, the crime-fighting alter ego of Bruce Wayne, wants to restore hope to his world, Gotham City. Now, in our world, people seem to get away with things quite a lot, don't they? I don't know if you've ever had experiences of maybe crime, and they haven't caught who perpetrated that crime. I've experienced that before. But a superhero movie doesn't come with those same limits, usually, because at least if the superhero is on your side of things, then you know that the bad guys are going to get justice. And in this clip from The Dark Knight, we'll see Batman pursuing a criminal who thinks he's escaped into Hong Kong from Gotham, and then he manages to deliver him back into the police force in Gotham City. Why do we love superheroes? Maybe one reason might be because they offer us a sense of justice being done. I hope you enjoy this clip. He's the baddie.
Can I cut? 楼下大堂三层楼。
Batman gets the job done. Could you turn to the person sitting next to you? Can you ask them this question? If you could have a superpower, what would it be? If you could have a superpower, what would it be? Okay. I want to ask the question, obviously lots of people with harboring superhero ambition out there. Where did superheroes come from? Where did superheroes come from? Perhaps looking at where superheroes came from can explain part of why we love them so much, why they're so big. And in order to answer this question, we actually need to go back a bit, back to New York in the late 1930s. Things are pretty bleak. Things weren't great. The Great Depression was hitting New York pretty hard. It was a severe worldwide economic depression. It started in 1930, and it was the longest, most widespread and deepest depression, financial depression of the 20th century. Unemployment in the USA rose to 25%. Agriculture, construction, heavy industry just collapsed. They all stopped for nearly 10 years. There just simply wasn't any. Huge queues started to form around people trying to get the basic necessities of life, as well as any possibility of a job. And this became a significant and serious threat to the American dream, that dream of economic prosperity to those who would work hard for it. And this was followed in September 1939 with the outbreak of another brutal global war and conflict, World War II. And at the same time as this, people were starting to suspect that in the sort of mid-1930s, people were starting to suspect that something odd was happening with the Nazis and the systematic persecution of the Jews and others. And the top right photo here is of a Jewish protest against the Nazis, which happened in New York, this protest, in November 1938. Now, this situation, all this sort of economic instability, as well as the sort of global instability going on, the outbreak of war coming, the rumoring of war, this coincided with a moral relativism. That is a view that what's right is just defined at the individual or personal level. This flowed out of some philosophical things that were going on, but widely people held the view that what's true for you was true for you. And so people were a bit skeptical about whether or not you could claim that things were right or things that were wrong, even though people like us had strong instincts about rape and pedophilia and things being definitely wrong. It was hard to express that because there was a widespread sort of skepticism about right and wrong in culture. There was therefore a profound cultural and moral hopelessness. People felt a bit lost. They didn't know whether or not they were going to be able to have jobs, whether or not they would be able to put food on the table. And that's even leaving aside the question of whether or not their brothers and their fathers would get killed in a war in a far-off place in Europe. What was going to happen? Well, into this sprang the first edition of Action Comics, issue number one. It appeared as an American comic book series in June 1938. And this was the first comic book which featured a superhero like Superman. The publisher later became known as DC Comics. Superman was created in this edition by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. It was a massive success. Pretty soon, other characters began to be added to that superhero genre. Action Comics became Detective Comics, featuring Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, The Flash, Aquaman, as well as the sort of antagonists, the baddies of Lex Luthor, the Joker, the Riddler, Catwoman, and the Penguin. Well, Marvel started a little while later in 1938, just a year or so later, and didn't really, though, get going in its creation of superheroes until the 1950s. That featured superheroes like Spider-Man, the X-Men, Fantastic Four, Iron Man, the Hulk, Captain America, Daredevil, and the baddies there were Magneto, the Green Goblin, Doctor Doom, and the Red Skull. I mean, maybe we can look forward to some of those appearing soon. All of these stories, Batman, Superman, the Green Lantern, the superhero stories, are stories which combat threats to our way of life. Superman's Metropolis and Batman's Gotham City were both tough places to live, lonely places. And there are very, very clear connections between Batman's Gotham, Superman's Metropolis, and New York, and the alienation, the depression of New York, that isolation. So cue the superhero entrance to, in a way, rescue the American dream. These superheroes could offer an escape, and perhaps even a hope of rescue. But the 21st century hasn't really felt much safer to many of us. We have terrorism, we have climate change, we have infectious diseases, and we still have huge economic instability. These are the sorts of problems that the superheroes came to save us from, and which may be part of their reason for their enduring popularity. They somehow give us hope in this sort of world, but they're there are some other reasons, I think, why superheroes still entertain us and why we're still drawn to them. There is a clear sense of right and wrong in a superhero movie. You know what's right and you know what's wrong. You know who the goodies are and you know who the baddies are. When real terrorists struck in 9/11, we didn't necessarily always feel that we had the vocabulary in society, the words and the concepts to be able to say that was wrong. And there were some who expressed skepticism about being able to even call those attacks wrong. We can actually cope with evil on the screen as long as it stays there. But actually, let's face it, the baddies often, to me, seem more interesting than the good guys. I don't know about you, but I find that a good baddie really makes a movie. And often I feel that the bad movies, just the baddies, haven't been bad enough. Maybe that says more about me than you, but we can really call things evil in a film. You can really point at some action or some activity or some motive or some person in a film, and you can say, that was wrong, that was evil. And I think part of the reason why we love superheroes and why we love superhero films is because it gives us this landscape where we have permission to call right things right and wrong things wrong. There isn't the same skepticism introduced into things that we have to deal with here, where much of the time we feel that there are shades of gray. Here's a clip from Spider-Man where you see the Green Goblin interrupting Aunt May, and she's praying the Lord's Prayer. She's praying the Our Father as he interrupts her. But for some reason, he seems intent on making her finish it. And only as she finishes and as she uses some of the words do you realize why he wants her to finish it and why he wants to identify particularly with some of the words that she utters at the end of the prayer. See if you can spot the connection that he wants her to make. Sorry about the weird subtitles.
Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us.
In a way, he wants her to call him evil because there's this definite sense of that being the vocabulary that's appropriate to him, that being what he's trying to do and trying to portray himself as. And he sort of finds humor in that. But actually, in a world of real right and wrong, we do realize that these are serious words. Maybe we want to find a place where we can use them, where we have a framework or a philosophy where we can feel that we're empowered to use them. Now, can you be a superhero? Can I be a superhero? Here's a question. The first superheroes were actually from above. I would include within this some of the superheroes of Greek mythology. I think that our modern superheroes are, in a way, a continuing imaginative exploration of some of those original Greek demigods or superheroes. And many of the early superheroes, including the Greek ones, were superheroes from what I call above. But much of the time now, superheroes are a bit more like us. They're superheroes from below. The early Spider-Man didn't really get bruised and broken and beaten up, just like the early James Bond didn't get scathed or shot or poisoned. But the later heroes seem to be more susceptible to taking some damage or taking some hits. It's as if we're searching for a more realistic superhero or maybe even a different type of hero. There isn't any way that it's more for us the interest in superheroes than simply the desire to have a superpower. It's not just about wanting to read minds or be able to fly through the air or be invisible or suck other people's superpowers from them, which is a winner, actually, if you're thinking of superhero gifts. But I think there's also this question of significance, as well as this moral landscape question, as well as the justice question, which we're maybe searching for somebody who can give us justice. There's also this idea of wanting to live in a world or in a life that's significant. We prayed just before I began to speak about feeling like we mattered, feeling like we were important and like God had a purpose for us in our lives. And I think there's that sense of this as well in our excitement about superhero films. You see, if you are a character in a superhero film, you matter. Your life is significant. What you're doing and the choices you make may save the world or send it the other way. Everybody's choices in a superhero matter, in a superhero movie matter, whether you're going to help people, whether you're not. And actually, I think we're drawn into superheroes not only because of justice, not only because of right and wrong, and because we want a vocabulary and a conceptual category to talk about right and wrong, but also because we want to live lives that are significant, that matter, that make an impact. I think that's one of the differences with our generation, is that maybe the older generation wanted to get out there and just be industrious and make money. We call them sometimes the baby boomers. But actually, sometimes I reflect at our generation and think, maybe we also want to do something that matters. We want to find a way of making the world more just. Now, cynicism creeps in quite quickly, doesn't it? And you and I tell each other, look, what can we possibly do? These are massive, global, intractable situations. But yet there is this hope in us that we could do something significant. We want to live lives that matter, as if we want to hammer out our lives in a significant way, somehow on that anvil of history. So there are superheroes who are from above. Here are a couple of examples. There's Superman. Now, I don't know if you ever watched the beginning of a Superman movie, but really it's one of the best bits, where you usually have Superman and the idea of his fatherhood and his origin coming from another planet. Here's from one of the more recent Superman films. Here's an example of that. And I just want you to see if you can hear any linguistic connections, any connections into any passages in the Bible you might be familiar with as you listen to these words.
far, my little girl. But we will never leave you, even in the face of our death. You will make my strength your own. You will see my life through your eyes, as your life will be seen through mine. The son becomes the father, and the father, the son.
Superman very clearly originates from outside. He's a hero who comes from outside, doesn't he? He's not human. That's one of the distinctives about Superman. He's not human at all. And in some ways, that is the thing that he struggles with most in his earthly life, is how can he experience love and still retain his superhero powers? And we know about all those discussions he has within himself and with Lois Lane about whether he can pursue his romantic interests with her and a life with her, or whether he needs to stand up and step up to retaining his superhero powers so he can fulfill his calling to be a kind of guardian and protector of planet Earth. He's caught in that, as if he can't be both the hero and the human. Another example of a hero from outside, although he starts off human, he's taken on by an organization from outside, is from the Green Lantern. And listen how, and look how Hal Jordan is told that a chosen ruling power has given him his superhero powers. So he's very much empowered from outside in a similar sort of way to Superman.
Have you concluded admiring yourself?
Yeah.
Well, your ring translator is functioning properly. Your mask will appear when protection of your identity is required. There's no need for it on Oa.
Talking fish.
Actually, my race is Zadarian. Our DNA does somewhat resemble your own ichthyological species. I am Tom Array, protector of Sector 2813 and home to
80,012 galaxies, 2.34 million sentient species. How do I know that?
The induction process. It activates the ring's higher functions, including a working knowledge base. In truth, we were curious. The process had never been attempted on a species as young as humans before. As you are the first to be chosen, I have been sent to welcome you here.
And here is?
Welcome to Oa. This planet has been our home for countless millennia. It was created for us by the Guardians.
Guardians?
There stands their citadel. They are immortals among the most ancient of races. They made all you see and are responsible for all we are and do. Since time immemorial, the Green Lantern Corps has served as the keepers of peace, order, and justice throughout the universe. To be chosen to join its ranks is the highest of honors. The greatest of responsibilities.
Yeah, that part I heard about.
We're going to fly now.
The Green Lantern actually is one of the most creative recent superhero films. If you haven't caught it, I recommend that you do. It's quite fun. So there are superheroes who are superheroes from above, like the Green Lantern and like Superman. Definitely not really human in a sort of normal sort of way, although Hal does start off that way. And then we have other types of superheroes who I call superheroes from below. People like Spider-Man, Peter Parker, who's just an ordinary guy who gets bitten by a spider.
Can I take your picture? I need one with a student in it.
Sure, yeah.
Great.
Where do you want me? Over here?
Yeah, that's great.
Don't make me look ugly.
That's impossible. Ah, perfect.
That's great.
MJ, let's go.
Wait. Thanks.
Do you see the TV screen behind him of the double helix moving around, suggesting what was going to happen? See, film directors love to put gentle sort of cues in the background of what's going on. So Spider-Man, I mean, he's a normal guy. In fact, that clip actually shows how his sort of bumbling, nerdy sort of personality. He's trying to make contact with MJ, and he doesn't quite know how to handle the situation and the conversation with her. And then you have other superheroes from below, superheroes like Iron Man, the Incredible Hulk, and others, who are fundamentally human in their basic substance and structure. They're like us. We look at them and say, well, what's the superpower that Batman really has? And maybe we might argue that Batman's not really a superhero. Or Iron Man, what's his superhero power? Because they seem sort of so human that almost we can't really clearly see what their superhero power is. But nevertheless, we regard them as superheroes, and they are profoundly human. I want you to see just that there are these two different types, superheroes from above and superheroes from below. Now, I'm just going to make sort of three points to finish. And these are really that I think in superhero films, we see echoes of humanity, echoes of the hero, and echoes of the rescue. Echoes of humanity, echoes of the hero, and echoes of the rescue. For example, I think we see an honesty in many films, not just superhero films, about our limitations, our weaknesses, our brokenness, even our sometimes darkness as human beings. I think that human beings are deeply glorious, wonderful beings. I think that each of you has a deep worth, value, and an intrinsic goodness to you. But I also think that, just like me, probably, there are things you struggle with. There are things you question in your own hearts. And there are probably things that, like you, would find in your heart that you sometimes need to say sorry to people for. Certainly, I've been married for 6 or 7 years, and my wife will tell you I've got some way to go before I need to stop apologizing. And there's something of an honesty in superhero films. I really, really enjoyed this scene, this conversation in The Dark Knight, in Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight film, where Harvey Dent is talking to Bruce Wayne over supper, over dinner, and they're talking about what kind of a hero people need and are looking for. And Harvey Dent has correctly guessed that Batman doesn't think that he's the hero that people need, but he's just sort of filling in until they can have a more public figure. But Harvey Dent also, in some way, inadvertently prophesized his own journey by saying that you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself becoming the villain. I think there's a profound honesty to that, and I hope you enjoy this clip.
Well, I was raised here. I turned out okay.
Is Wayne Manor in the city limits?
The Palisades?
Sure.
You know, as our new DA, you might want to figure out where your jurisdiction ends.
I'm talking about the kind of city that idolizes a masked vigilante.
Gotham City is proud of an ordinary citizen standing up for what's right.
Gotham needs heroes like you, elected officials, not a man who thinks he is above the law.
Exactly. Who appointed the Batman?
We did. All of us who stood by and let scum take control of our city.
But this is a democracy, Harvey.
When their enemies were at the gates, the Romans would suspend democracy and appoint one man to protect the city. It wasn't considered an honor. It was considered a public service.
Harvey, the last man that they appointed to protect the Republic was named Caesar, and he never gave up his power.
Okay, fine. You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Look, whoever the Batman is, he doesn't want to do this for the rest of his life. How could he? Batman is looking for someone to take up his mantle.
Someone like you, Mr. Dent?
Maybe. If I'm up to it.
What if...
It's a foreboding conversation. But I think there's an honesty to it, that you either die as a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. I really think there's something to that. Now, in this next clip from Iron Man, what we're going to see is this idea of Tony Stark's view of himself. And I think that's one of the reasons why we really like Tony Stark and why he's one of the most appealing contemporary superhero type characters, because there's such a humility and a kind of honesty to his own knowledge of his own failings. I actually think this flows from the actor who plays him's own experiences, because he's very publicly struggled with alcoholism. And so that same weakness, I think that same vulnerability actually carries through in the acting. In any case, I want you to just notice how the character, the central character, Tony Stark, engages with this accusation that he is a textbook narcissist, as well as enjoying the trailer for the film.
Our priority is to get the Iron Man weapon turned over to the United States of America.
I am Iron Man. The suit and I are one.
I want to make the Iron Man look like an antique.
Come on!
That displays textbook narcissism. Agreed?
There's an honesty to him, even if we don't always see his humility evident. But there are moments, I think, of honesty with Tony Stark. Here's the director of Iron Man 3, Shane Black, talking about the character journey of Tony Stark.
Marvel has stressed this thing, the crucible element, that we take Tony Stark and we sort of break him down and bring her. There may even be parts in this movie where he's not so much in the Iron Man suit, but where he's more like a, you know, what if Tony Stark had to be James Bond for a little bit and didn't have his Iron Man suit? And that's a lot of fun, too, is when you see him do some action stuff, not as Iron Man, but as Tony. And it's part of him sort of being reduced, being broken, and having to reassess things and then stand back up and reclaim what's his by the end of the movie. But that journey and that crucible, I think, is what's going to be fun, because we're going to see Robert within the course of just a few days put through the paces. And he's the one to bring that sort of a thing to life.
He is the one to bring that sort of a thing to life. I think that's what I meant by his honesty and his own journey. So in Iron Man 3, we also see the same sort of tension going on. What do you see in Iron Man 3 about Tony Stark's view of himself? I think one of the taglines that comes out of Iron Man 3 is that we sometimes fight not against the demons that come from out there or the baddies that come from out there, but the demons that we create ourselves or we find in ourselves. I wonder if you can spot some of the honest reflections about human struggles and humanity here in this clip and trailer for Iron Man 3.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally save the world. So why can't I sleep?
You elected me on a single platform. I will defend this country at all costs. The Mandarin must be stopped.
You don't know who I am.
What are you going to do about these attacks?
The whole world's going to be watching.
The question is, where is Tony Stark?
Things are different now. I have to protect the one thing that I can't live without. That's you. Mr. Stark. Today is the first day what's left of your life. I'm gonna offer the choice. Do you want an empty life or a meaningful death?
I'm not afraid of you. No politics here. Just good old-fashioned revenge. backup.
That's your department.
Here's my boys.
Couple of moments in there. Why can't I sleep? As I said, we're often fighting against the demons that we create ourselves, which is a key theme from the film. And this idea of knowing your limitations and not overstepping them and protecting what's dear to you. Here's Gwyneth Paltrow, who plays Pepper Potts in Iron Man 3, talking about how this theme of light and dark is actually a theme that connects with every single one of us. I think there's a real honesty in what she says here.
I think the reason that Iron Man is so successful is because, you know, it's that classic archetypal figure of, like, somebody with incredible light and darkness, and that's a story of all of us, and we're always trying to reconcile both sides of ourselves and all parts of ourselves, and there's something emblematic about Iron Man kind of encompassing all of those qualities, and it's what we strive to do, you know.
I think there's a real honesty to this. I wonder if I can invite you to attempt some of the same sort of honesty as you turn to the person sitting next to you. And if you haven't introduced yourself, then maybe now's the time to do that. And just ask them this question. If you were a superhero, what would one of your struggles be? What might one of your struggles be if you were a superhero? Just going to give you a couple of minutes to talk about that question with the person sitting next to you. So don't be shy and shuffle over to chat to somebody if you're not sitting next to someone.
What would your struggle be? Okay, well, let me know when you thought of it.
Okay, not only are you a group with lots of desires for superpowers, you've obviously got a lot of struggles too, because you've got a lot to say there. Just reflecting back on all of this together, just reflecting back, I've talked about how we have superheroes from above, and I wonder if that echoed in your mind with any other kind of ways of looking at reality or ways of looking at heroes. I'd like to make the connection into Christian theology and into the Bible, into the story and life of Jesus, because I think that there's a real connection here between superheroes from above and Jesus. If you think back to these words, "This is my son whom I love, with him I'm well pleased." These are words from Matthew's eyewitness testimony concerning Jesus. You'll find it in Matthew chapter 3 if you want to look in a Bible. And the words go like this. The sort of the context is this. As soon as Jesus is baptized, he's being baptized in the river, and he went up out of the water. And at that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I'm well pleased." Now, although the Father here doesn't cease to exist when the Son carries on living, as in the case of Superman, the father dies, doesn't he, in the planetary explosion of the home planet. There are echoes between Superman's story and Jesus' story. And I think that here is an example of where we're seeing an echo in the imagination of mankind for actually this deeper story, the story of the gospel. And then we've got superheroes who are superheroes from below. They're superheroes like us. They share a full humanity like us. They can die, they can get hurt pretty easily in the same sorts of ways that we can get hurt. They bleed and they get broken and they cry. And in the same sort of way, we see Jesus as well, fully human. Jesus himself is another connection into this idea of superheroes from below or heroes from below. And it's as if, again, the imagination of mankind through history is reaching out or echoing out, if you like, the hope of a hero who not only is from beyond, but also is like us and can identify with us. It's clear enough from Jesus, from the New Testament, that Jesus had a human body. We read in John's Gospel in chapter 1, the Word became flesh. And Jesus' humanity and acknowledging Jesus' humanity, his bodiedness, his embodiedness, is actually one of the first tests of Orthodox Christian teaching in the early church. Jesus was born, he grew tired, he got thirsty, he got hungry, he was physically weak sometimes, and he actually died. He had a real human body after his resurrection as well. I don't think there's many verses which summarize Jesus' humanity as much as this. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them at the inn. That verse really sort of speaks of the, if you've ever been present at a childbirth, there's a profound sort of messy humanity to it. It's an incredible encounter, an incredible experience. I was present at the birth of both of my kids, and it really brings us back to the full humanity, actually, the full humanness of Jesus and who he really was. So Jesus, I think, is both a superhero from beyond, empowered from beyond, but he's also like us. In some ways, he is the superhero that combines all our imaginative yearnings for a superhero in one person. In some ways, maybe he's the hero that we're reaching for or yearning for or even echoing for. Ben Kingsley, who's one of the actors from Iron Man 3, talks about how superhero movies are appealing to us because they contain eternal truths in them that speak to longings that we all experience and that we all feel. Let's see what you make of what he says.
They have their own logic, as I was saying earlier, and they are rooted in patterns of human behavior that are undeniably true. So obviously audiences will find contagious and they'll go out and they'll probably say, wow, amazing. But what's behind that wow, amazing is there's something in there that I recognize as being eternally true. And that makes a great comic hero because they have to be something to do with eternal truths that we long for, all of them.
I don't know if you've ever noticed, but as we go through life, the experiences that you thought would satisfy you sometimes don't. Maybe you've got a favorite type of music or favorite band or a favorite movie director, or maybe you have a favorite type of literature or a favorite activity or a favorite enterprise that you like to be involved in. Maybe you're a member of the drama society or something and you love just putting on plays, but you're always sad when those times come to an end. I'm sure that you've experienced a certain amount of feeling that there must have been more to this experience. I sort of was promised more, or I expected more from this experience. And I think every single one of us, if we're honest, will admit to sometimes experiencing that. It might be in the form of love and intimacy. It might be that one of the things that my wife has given me permission to share publicly is that even though we have a really nice communicative, we're both sort of Mediterranean in temperament, so we both have quite a communicative, open relationship, we talk a lot. There's even a moment in our relationship, quite frequently, where we say to each other, look, I have a thirst for intimacy and for closeness and to be loved that's beyond what you can provide me with. And she's willing to say that to me, and I'm willing to admit that to her. And it's as if there's a yearning in us. I don't know what the most romantic relationship or the closest friendship you've ever been in, and whether you just reflect on that now, just think, was there a sense that I was wanting more? I was wanting more intimacy, more closeness, more acceptance. even if those relationships were very accepting, were very intimate, and were very close, there's a yearning in us as human beings to be known at such a deep level. The problem is, quite often, is that we're afraid to really open ourselves up, make ourselves really vulnerable, because we carry with us a certain amount of shame for some things that we are, and some things that we think, and some things that we feel. And so we don't always get to that level of intimacy. And we're almost looking for somebody who can deal with our shame, who can put some way of kind of sanitizing all that, or removing all that, and then really see us as we are. But I'm not sure whether a human being can ever fulfill that for us. In the same sort of way, I think we have a desire for purity. I don't know if you've noticed, but in modern life, we sometimes go between being different identities in different places. Maybe you have your sort of home life when you're not at uni, or when you're not here, or in a different location, and you have this sort of different identity in that location or with that group of friends, perhaps, or maybe it's something that you do online. And then you have this identity, and maybe you have a few different identities that you have in different places, and people have talked about how to be a modern self is to be a fragmented self, or to be a buffered self. And there's this question of how we can become more integrated as people and less fragmented. I certainly experience that. And I want to be more sort of whole as a person. I don't know if you'd identify with that at all. And there's a yearning in me as well for purity, for inner peace, for a cleanness inside me, to be washed clean, to not carry with me any shame, any of those memories of things that I've done wrong. And then thirdly, I think there's a longing for home. There's a longing for a place that's safe. There's a longing for a place that is secure. Maybe you've been in a circumstance where you're on a trip or a holiday, or you're with a particular group of people, or maybe it's right now and you don't want this time to end. And there's a yearning for a place that's secure, where you're accepted, where you're using your gifts, and you're being acknowledged and encouraged in using your gifts. And there can be a fear, you know, what will I do if this ends? Because we know that these are seasons that life gives to us, where we feel like we're being secure, and we feel secure, and we feel like we're being effective as people. And actually that yearning as well, I think, is like a yearning for home, or a yearning for a place, as well as a yearning to be an effective person. And we have all kinds of yearnings and longings that I'm not sure that we can see fulfillment in the substances and in the materials and in the relationships merely of this world. C.S. Lewis spent quite a lot of time thinking along these themes as well, and he wrote this. He said, "If I find inside myself a desire that this world cannot satisfy, then the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." I think that's really, really quite insightful. That maybe this unsatisfied desire in us for something more than human relationships, for something more than these experiences of life, as wonderful as they are, for this clear sense of right and wrong, for this clear sense and clear idea and delivery of justice, and for this clear significance that we want our lives to have. I think that these are all longings, are all experiences, are all yearnings in us. Longings of the heart, you might say, that point maybe to something else. That's what Lewis would say, that if I find inside myself a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, then maybe I was made for another world. I wonder what you make of all of that. I wonder how you respond to that. When I arrived at university 13 years ago, I wasn't a Christian. I started to study philosophy and computer science, but I wasn't a Christian believer. But I found that as I started to study philosophy, I began to doubt, not my faith, because I didn't have any, but I began to doubt my materialism, my view that everything in the world was physical and material, and that natural explanations would be sufficient to explain everything. A professor called Anthony Flew wrote an article about 7 years ago, and in this article he admitted that he'd come to believe in God. Now, what was significant about this admission was that for the last 50 years, he was the foremost defender philosophically of atheism. Now, he didn't come to Christian faith, but he came to acknowledge that there was a God. He came to believe that there was a God of some kind. And in the last few years of his life, was quite taken with N.T. Wright's explorations of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. He wrote in his book, There Is a God, the last book that he wrote, He wrote this. He actually, in his younger years, he debated C.S. Lewis in Oxford. He wrote this in his book. He said, "No other figure, no other religion enjoys anything like the combination of a charismatic figure like Jesus and a first-class intellectual like St. Paul. If you're wondering if God has set up a religion, it seems to me that this is the one to beat." Now, I think Anthony Flew's right. I think that one person who stands out in 60 billion is worth a second glance. So let's glance again at him. H.G. Wells calls him the most dominant figure in history. We've got no record of his date of birth, yet the world's history and chronology is linked to it. He never wrote a book. He never wrote a single line of writing, and yet more books have been written about him than anyone else in history. The output of those books is accelerating even at this moment. The nearest thing that we have to his bibliography, it's been translated into 2,000 different languages. He never painted a picture. He never composed any poetry or music. And yet nobody's life and teaching have inspired a greater output of songs, plays, poetry, films, videos, and other art forms. One film based on his recorded words has been translated into 100 different languages. It's the most watched film in history. He never raised an army, yet millions of people have laid down their lives in his cause peacefully, and every year thousands more do so. Except for one brief period in his childhood, his travels are limited to just one small country. And now his influence is worldwide. His followers constitute the largest religious grouping that the world has ever known or seen. He had no formal education, and yet thousands of universities, seminaries, colleges, schools have been founded in his name. His public teaching lasted 3 years, was restricted to this tiny country, and now purpose-built satellites, the world's largest radio and television networks, beam his message around the globe. He was virtually unknown outside that native country of his. And yet the last issue of Encyclopedia Britannica runs, the entry under his name runs to 30,000 words. He is the most controversial person in history. Nobody has attracted such adoration, such excitement, and yet such opposition, such criticism. Nobody's teaching has ever been so fervently and excitedly received, or so fiercely and angrily rejected. For centuries, every recorded word that he said and events that he did are being relentlessly analyzed by philosophers, by archaeologists, by historians, by theologians, and others. And right now, as we're thinking about his life and the impact of his life on history, millions of people around the globe are studying the importance or the value of his words and actions and are trying to apply them to their own lives. The historian Philip Schaff says this: Jesus, without money and arms, conquered more millions than Alexander, Caesar, Muhammad, and Napoleon. Without science, he shed more light on things human and divine than all philosophers and scholars combined. Without the eloquence of schools, he spoke such words of life as were never spoken before or since, and produced effects which lie beyond the reach of orator or poet. Without writing a single line, he set more pens in motion, furnished themes for more sermons, orations, discussions, learned volumes, works of art, and songs of praise than the whole army of great men of ancient and modern times. Lecky says in his History of European Morality, says this: the character of Jesus has not only been the highest pattern of virtue, but the strongest incentive in its practice, and has exerted so deep an influence that it may truly be said that that record of those simple, short 3 years of active life have done more to regenerate and soften mankind than all the dispositions of philosophers and all the exhortations of moralists. Now, I don't know whether you have noticed, but this summary, as astonishing as it is to reflect on it, actually leaves out the thing that was right at the heart of who Jesus was and is. We've touched on it a little bit in talking about superheroes from above and superheroes from below. Right at the center of who he was and what he was about, he claimed to be God. He claimed to be God come to mankind. Claims and demonstrations of supernatural power surrounded his interactions with people. Insights into people's lives, how could he have them? He caused people's limbs to grow back in plain sight. He exercised power over the natural world in front of people. Ancient prophecies became fulfilled that were outside of his control, like the place of his birth and the manner of his death. Who was he? Who do you say he was? So I encountered Christian philosophers when I got to university. And they presented arguments, reasonable intellectual arguments, why this Jesus and the stories about him were reasonable, were reliable, could be taken seriously by thinking people. I read through their books. I read through their articles. I read through the historical sources, and I looked into things for myself. And gradually, over the course of a few months, I began to be persuaded that there was something interesting to this Jesus guy, that he was worth investigating further, that he was worth looking into. I wonder if you have ever done an exploration like that. I wonder if you have ever gone on a journey like that. Maybe for you, your faith was something that your parents believed, and that maybe you need also to take ownership of your own beliefs and your own journey to discover and to investigate who he really was and what the evidence for him was. For me, that led to slowly becoming convinced that God existed. Then finding Jesus as a possible representation of God and looking into the evidence for him. And then finally coming to acknowledge that Jesus was actually persuasive as far as his claims to be God went. And then I started to discover what Jesus was all about and why he was doing it. Not just leaving him at this divine claim, but actually discovering more of what was going on behind his mission, behind his heart, behind the cross. I discovered, and I didn't know this, that God didn't view mankind in a kind of abstract way. He didn't feel unmoved by mankind, but actually God was looking at humankind and looking at you and I with love, with brokenness, with compassion, but also love. The Bible says, the words of Jesus in the Bible say, "For God so loved the world that he sent his son." And that was totally earth-shattering for me, because I didn't understand how motivation for Jesus coming could flow out of love until I began to discover that actually it was the love between the Father and the Son that really was being revealed through what the Son was doing on the cross. And so I began to learn more about how, yes, I was willing to admit that I needed forgiveness sometimes, and yes, I was willing to admit that, just like Tony Stark and the different characters in these superhero films who admit their fallibility, I was willing to admit that, yeah, okay, before a holy God, I might need to ask for forgiveness. But I didn't understand how that worked until somebody sat me down and I began to understand and began to read about how this sense of shame that I felt, and that sometimes I met people and they were willing to admit that they felt too, had been put on Jesus on the cross. And that this meant that that barrier that I felt in terms of being able to be truly intimate with somebody like God, that barrier of shame, of vulnerability, was removed by the cross. And I could then begin to glimpse and see what Christians talked about as grace. This idea that God loves us, that he's for us, that he wants to make us clean, that he wants to stand us up on our feet again, that he wants to fulfill those longings and desires that we run around trying to fulfill in this life. But actually, he stands ready to fulfill that, and he can have relationship with us because he's created a way for us to know him through the cross. Now, some of you have heard this 100 times, maybe more than 100 times. But yet still, it washes over you somehow, and you're not living in a reality of it being for you. Others of you are hearing Jesus' message, maybe put like this for the first time. And you can see how superheroes perhaps and the imagination on our yearning for justice all concretely comes to converge on what's happening on the cross. Because at the cross, God carries out this justice. God carries out this act of supreme love. And Jesus goes willingly to that cross. The superhero who was willing to be a hero, to be broken, and through his weakness, not through his power, overcomes death, rising again to show that he really is who he claimed to be. And I wonder where you are in all of that. Maybe you're at more of an investigating kind of stage, and if that's the case for you, then I just want to encourage you, like I wish somebody had said to me 12, 13 years ago, keep going, keep asking, keep looking. There'll be better writers out there. There'll be better thinkers out there. You might think you've got an answer that's a dead end, but keep pushing. There will be an answer to that question. It will stand up to scrutiny if it's true. So I just want to encourage you, keep investigating. Keep asking questions of those people around you. Keep asking them to give you books. Maybe you're at a point where you need to accept this, where you need to actually say, yeah, I really just need to acknowledge this. I need to receive this grace, and I need to live in this grace. I need to connect together all this other yearning for fulfillment in life that I've been looking for. I want to decompartmentalize my life and defragment it. And I know that Jesus can start to do that if I really live under his lordship, if I really come to him in full submission. Do you think that Jesus is really the hero that you're living for? Maybe you're the hero that you're living for. Maybe you're the hero in your life in a kind of practical way. You acknowledge Jesus on Sunday, but maybe in your life the hero that you're really living for is a girlfriend or a boyfriend or somebody else, or maybe even yourself. Jesus has confronted all of that. He's confronted that. He's defeated it. He knows that there's something wrong with our hearts. He knows that he can make us clean, and he offers to do that. It's an invitation. What are you going to do with that invitation? How will you handle it? I'm going to put on a song. I'm just going to play a little music video. It's from the beginning of a song by Brooke Fraser called the C.S. Lewis song. And the song uses the words of C.S. Lewis, that if I find inside myself a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, then maybe I was made for a different world. Now, I'm going to play the song for a couple of minutes, and then I'll fade it down. And I'm going to come back, and I'm going to pray a prayer when I come back. And the prayer is very simply, sorry, thank you, and please. And I want you to use that as an opportunity for you to either significantly reconnect and recommit to Jesus and knowing him as your hero, or maybe for the first time, entering into the freedom of that new relationship, looking to him to deal with that shame on the cross and entering into that new relationship with God. I wonder if you just use that as a point of reflection just over the next minute or two as I play that.
Desires nothing in this world can satisfy. I can only conclude that I was not made for here. If the flesh that I fight is at best
ask you if you wouldn't mind just bowing your heads and closing your eyes, even if you're at an investigate type of stage. Just use this as a moment of reflection. Please don't feel any pressure whatsoever. But I wonder if you would just join with me if you want to say yes to Jesus, and if you want to give him your shame and give him that stuff that you struggle with and receive that forgiveness and enter into that new relationship with him, then just pray with me. I'll tell you the words of the prayer. I'm just going to say, sorry, thank you, and please. Sorry for the things I've done wrong, Lord God. Thank you that you died for me. Please come into my life and I will follow you. Please forgive me for what I've done wrong. So I'm just going to pray those three things. So if you wouldn't mind, if that's you and you know that God is reaching out to you, then would you say yes in your own heart as I pray? Let's pray. Lord God, I'm sorry for the things that I've done wrong. Thank you that you died for me on the cross to open a way to deal with my shame. Please come into my life and start that new relationship with me that I might know you and follow you for all my days. Amen. Now, if you, if that was a significant moment for you, then I would love to pray with you. Winston, my colleague, would love to pray with you. Or you can approach the pastoral staff here, maybe your small group leader or your pastor here, and ask them to support you in this commitment. And they will put you in touch with people who can meet up with you and study the Bible with you, who can give you maybe a book to read to get you back into that living, loving relationship with Jesus, or maybe to help you get on the right road in that relationship. My prayer is that each of us would tonight have glimpsed that Jesus Christ is the superhero that we're all searching for. And I wish you well on your investigations, if that's where you are. I'd love to talk to you more or to offer to pray with you afterwards. I'm going to hand over to the band now.